Hello, and welcome back to On the Nose, the Jewish Currents podcast. I'm Ariel Angel, editor-in-chief of Jewish Currents, and I will be your host for today. In the public sphere, the discursive battle over Israel and Palestine is primarily a battle over language, with individual words and phrases like apartheid or settler colonialism, the right to exist, or human shields becoming stand-ins for entire worldviews. Since October 7th, mainstream and independent media alike have been faced with endless choices about how to represent the unfolding events. Which words are used to describe the Hamas attacks and which ones are used to describe those of the Israeli military, for example? And what does it say about the perceived humanity of each group of victims? What to do with words like genocide or war crimes, which will take some time to adjudicate legally, but which also serve a function in naming unfolding events in the present? This isn't just a question about words, but also grammar and syntax. In a pattern reminiscent of reporting on police attacks on Black Americans, headlines often employ the passive voice when dealing with Israeli military actions, obscuring culpability for those responsible for attacks on Palestinians. As feminist theorist Sophie Lewis wrote recently, a world rising up in outrage against Israel's atrocities has been met by a media that can barely represent Palestinian personhood at the level of syntax. At Jewish Currents, we make an effort to be careful with our language and to avoid some of the missteps of mainstream media, which contribute to the dehumanization of Palestinian people. And still, questions about language crop up constantly, and the answers are not always so clear-cut, both in a hard news context and in the context of more magazine-style writing. To talk about these fraught questions of language in the media today, I have three amazing guests. Ali Gharib, a senior editor at The Intercept. Hi, Ali.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Dalia Hatuka is an independent journalist and Jewish Currents contributor specializing in Palestinian-Israeli affairs.
Hello.
And Jasmine Hughes, a National Magazine Award winner and former New York Times Magazine writer. Thanks for joining us, Jasmine.
Thank you for having me.
So, Ali, I want to start with you since The Intercept has been doing really crucial reporting these last couple months on what's going on inside mainstream newsrooms. I'm thinking specifically of both the analysis of the words used in reports in major newspapers thus far, and also the reporting that you've done going inside newsrooms like the CNN and the New York Times and looking at sort of what their top brass is, how they're instructing their reporters. So I was wondering if you could summarize a little bit of that reporting.
Yeah, I mean, we've done a bunch of stories, mostly focusing on CNN and the Times, as you said, just about kind of the pressures that writers are feeling at different levels, showing some of the interests at work. You know, like the executive editor of the Times, his father was on the board of this kind of like a right-wing pro-Israel smear shop called Camera. Just relationships like that, and just kind of trying to piece together the ways in which these pressures are brought to bear on people in the newsroom, because not all reporters are great, but a lot of times reporters are a lot more sensible than the brass at these places and are trying to do the right thing. But the pressures on them are often really incredible.
Yeah, I mean, just bringing in some of The Intercept reporting here at CNN, for example, the reporters were told that whenever they describe the Ministry of Health, they should say Hamas controlled, and that should precede any mention of the casualties. Or the idea that war crime and genocide are taboo words, somebody who works at CNN told The Intercept, and that, this is a quote, Israel bombings in Gaza will be reported as blasts attributed to nobody until the Israeli military weighs in to either accept or deny responsibility. The Intercept also did another analysis just basically on the words that different newsrooms have used.
Yeah, that was Adam Johnson and Othman Ali, and they wrote a sort of quantitative analysis, sort of analyzing the Times as well as other major newspapers. The words that they used, like the Palestinian death toll was mentioned at a much lower proportion than the Israeli one in this conflict so far. There were words used like for the October 7th attacks was referred to as a slaughter of Israelis, but that word is almost never used to describe the attacks against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The Times did a lot of articles focusing on the children that were casualties of the October 7th attack and much less on the attacks against the Gaza Strip, where we know that there's been an incredible death toll of children in the Strip, you know, such a young population. And Adam and Othman were able to kind of like show how, you know, it tilts one way, you know, like you could impute motive on that and ascribe it to the motives of journalists at these outlets. But like, it doesn't really even matter what the motives are at that point when you just look at the numbers and it's that clear how it shakes out.
Right. I mean, with children in particular, they talked about the hostage exchange, and you have children being exchanged on one side, the Israeli hostages, and people under 18 for the children that are being held in Israeli prisons who were released. So there's a real one-to-one comparison in terms of the ways that people are being described. Zalia, I wanted to turn to you. I mean, you write for a number of different outlets, and I was wondering if you could talk just personally about how questions of language have been coming up for you in your work since October 7th and even before, maybe both in terms of the decisions that you're making before a piece even gets to an editor, and maybe the ways that you're navigating what comes back.
A while back, I wrote a piece for the New York Times, and it took like 3 weeks of editing. And I had an excellent editor who I'm sure did a lot of like hard work in the background and fought a good fight. But when finally it was going to be published, one of the editors inserted something in there like condemning Hamas or something. But the focus of the piece was about something else entirely. And it felt like me just being Palestinian, like I had to kind of like sign this disclaimer. And I was like, no, I don't want to do this, you know? And then finally, we kind of came to like a mutual agreement. And it finally came out.
I was wondering, Jasmine, kind of the same question. I mean, I know you're in magazine writing, and you have been, and also that you left your role at the Times right after October 7th. But even beforehand, I think there were a number of debates roiling at the Times also about transgender issues, also about reporting on police violence. And I was curious how you have navigated questions of language in your work and with your editors.
I write largely about entertainment and celebrity culture. And so I think that my personal sort of misgivings around language were always centered around Black identity and Black identification, right? Like my first real brush up with the ways that the New York Times allows its reporters to deploy language was when a white editor told me that I was allowed to use the N-word in a story. And she didn't censor herself. She actually repeated herself. And so, in order to stay safe and sane, I tried really hard to work with editors with whom not only could I have this sort of intimate, safe space, but also editors who I know would defend me once we got further down the line and people wanted to insert things into a story that I might not have agreed with. And for the most part, for my actual stories, that all went very successfully. But as I guess now an alumnus of the New York Times, I worked there for almost 9 years. One thing that particularly worries me is the decreasing channels for dissent and the ways in which we are seeing the masthead, the top brass of the paper, crack down on any sort of dissent. I have seen venues for dissent or even venues to ask questions shrink and shrink over time. I'm sure you guys saw an op-ed published by a staff opinion writer, Pamela Paul, that came out maybe a month ago, that there were some employees of the paper who were in the queer employee resource group's Slack channel, wanting to like find a safe space, but also an official space to air their grievances about coverage, who were swiftly shut down. They saw their Slack messages get deleted, even though they were dissenting internally and quite respectfully, and making the case that, you know, it felt like the paper was slowly becoming a more hostile workplace. And unfortunately, those messages were deleted, and those employees were told that it went against the Times' policy against public protest. Even though it was internal, even though it was literally in the Slack channel dedicated to queer New York Times employees who both entered that space looking for a sense of community, but also to engender a sense of safety for queer employees of the New York Times. And so it's been quite striking to look at a publication that is predicated on free speech, a free press, to turn around and try to stymie that same action within the newsroom, within its own company. It feels incredibly confusing and also like incredibly disgusting, but also I worry that there's a sort of like holier than thou sentiment that's really sort of starting to travel around, especially when they are now sort of immersed in this culture of like, you're so lucky to be here, which is a sentence I heard over and over and over again. And this is the most important work you'll ever do.
Yeah. I mean, Jasmine, you had a very public resignation from the Times, pressured resignation after signing a letter by Writers Against the War on Gaza, calling for a ceasefire and a boycott, among other things. And the Times said that that violated their policy on public protest. In an interview with Democracy Now! Afterwards, you said, you know, objectivity is a beautiful project for a world that doesn't exist.
Yeah, I think the only way that objectivity works in the ways that the powers that be wish it does is if they turn that focus, that camera lens on themselves, right? Like Ali, you just mentioned that Joe Kahn, the editor-in-chief of the New York Times, his father sat on the board of CAMRA. Joe Kahn was also the paper's Jerusalem bureau chief. Like, I think that if we want to cry objectivity, then like, everyone should come with a laundry list of their potential biases. And that's insane. That's totally impossible. And so I have difficulty figuring out where objectivity goes. But I also think that it is unfortunately become a tool to keep people of marginalized identities, journalists with marginalized identities, out of stories that they otherwise would be fantastic at. But that's very rarely like turned upon people who are of the majority of the newsroom, whether that's among race or among class or among gender. For example, I'm really curious about how many people on the upper masthead, the upper echelons of the New York Times have completed a birthright trip. That doesn't necessarily mean anything about you, but that's like a really critical piece of bias that I think would be just as germane as something like me, a magazine reporter, signing a letter decrying a genocide.
I mean, I think Jasmine's exactly right that, like, the idea of not taking a side actually is taking a side, and it's for a status quo that is not going to work for a lot of people, but works for a small select few. And so I also think that's kind of, like, bullshit. You know, I'm lucky enough to work in a place where we don't have to pretend like we don't have independent and individual thoughts about things, but the journalism always comes first. Like, if you're going to put it on the page, you better be able to back it up and prove it. That's kind of my approach to it, is that, look, if you can report it, let's do it. And if you can't, then we leave it off and you can like tweet about it or whatever you want.
What sorts of conversations or thinking do you all have around retractions? Because, for example, within the New York Times, like obtaining a retraction or even obtaining a correction is often a really lengthy process. I think both like out of this idea that, you know, has benefited me, that like you stand behind your writer and you stand behind their reporting and the editing and what have you. But also I think there's this idea that if they bend to every sort of request for a correction, then that's all that they would ever do. And I also think the Times takes its positionality as the paper of record quite seriously. And so my experience has been like corrections are really, really hard to come by. Retractions are nearly impossible. And I wonder what those conversations are like for you.
Yeah, I mean, I was working with one of our more headstrong reporters the other day on a request for a correction, and they were kind of worked up about it. And you hear people say stuff like, you know, I haven't had a correction in however many years. And it's like, well, then I got questions. It sounds to me like you think you got everything right, and nobody does that. And this wasn't the same reporter, but I told him, like, for me, the occasional correction is really a badge of honor rather than one of shame, because it shows that you're willing to show when you've been wrong. And, you know, and I say this as someone who did a story questioning the New York Times reporting process on their story about sexual violence on October 7. And we did corrections to that story. And, you know, we're not like in print being like the New York Times should retract or correct or update or whatever. We're just showing problems and they can do with it what they want. But like, I think it's pretty telling that they haven't even appended an update or like in subsequent stories, like updated the information that they related. Like, it's just like, never question any of that is the ethos. It's really old school in a way. I think it has to do with exactly they're thinking they're the paper of record. It has to do with them thinking they're like actually on paper, which is not really relevant anymore. And yeah, I mean, for me, I'm always open to it. Take requests for corrections seriously. Oftentimes, I'm more up for doing corrections than the writers themselves.
I definitely am. I mean, I think you have to take every single request seriously and make your own adjudication. So maybe it would be helpful to give you guys an example from my work. When we identify the Israeli military, obviously the Israeli military has named itself the Israeli Defense Forces. You have some outlets like Mondo Weiss and Electronic Intifada, for example, that will only use Israeli Occupation Forces, IOF. For myself, as the editor-in-chief of Jewish Currents, IDF is not very comfortable because it is the expression of Israeli power and hegemony and the way that they want to be seen in the world. And IOF is not very comfortable because it's not that legible. And it immediately marks the outlet as an outlet that is speaking to a specific audience that is already on board or has already internalized this shift in language. So we usually just say the Israeli military. That's the way that we deal with that. But I wanted to ask how you think about, and maybe Dalia, I'll start with you, how you think about the question of both not wanting to just represent the power structure while also recognizing when you might be on the forefront of different kinds of language or where you might be tipping off your readers to a certain kind of alignment. And how do you balance those concerns?
For me, this example is very relevant. I don't think I've ever, and I could be wrong, but I've never myself inserted the word IDF into a story. I've had squabbles with the editors about it who wanted to call it IDF. I always call it the Israeli army or the Israeli military, you know, Israeli forces, Israeli soldiers, but never IDF and also never IOF because like, what the hell is that? I mean, I know they're occupying forces, but like, what are we saying here? You know, like not that they're both equal. I mean, I get why people would want to use it, you know, but they're catering to a specific readership or, you know, listenership or whatever. So I try to keep these things on the sidelines. But also for me, like, you know, I'm proud that I'm Palestinian, but I'm a journalist first, and I owe it to my profession to relay the story with the view or the idea that, you know, many different kinds of people are reading my work or listening to me and what have you.
Yeah, I mean, I like to always be legible to readers that are not always going to be like high information readers. Like I want those people to be able to open an article and read it all the way through and understand everything that's going on as well. Especially I find myself, if there's a quote that says IDF, I'll like introduce Israel Defense Forces earlier in the story. But like, you know, at some point it's a proper name. Like where does it end? Is The Intercept going to decide to call it the War Department and the War Secretary? Or are we going to call Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense?
Well, what's interesting is that we just got this guide from a group called Words About War. And their like first line is, discussions of war and foreign policy are full of dehumanizing euphemisms, bloodless jargon, little known government acronyms, and troubling metaphors that hide war's damage. They say, for example, don't say defense spending, say military spending or like Pentagon spending. This is in the context of American foreign policy. Like don't say boots on the ground or whatever, use troops. And they do mention the War Department. They don't say like call it the War Department, but they do say call it the Pentagon.
I mean, you know, I'll call it the Department of Corrections, but I'm not going to be like Corrections Officer Union in our own editorial voice. They're fucking prison guards. And that's what I want to call them because that is legible to everyone. Everyone understands their guards. And like, what are these people correcting? Nothing. It's a euphemism to hide what they do. Like all the time, I'm thinking about that kind of stuff. But there's like a part of me that maybe is just like, is a little too old school. And I don't mind using the proper names when they fit.
I mean, I don't think it's necessarily old school. I mean, like, I think what we're talking about is that there's really a trade-off here. I mean, all of us have read leftist outlets where like they immediately announce themselves in a certain kind of way. And they're also sometimes kind of unreadable. I mean, like the jargon kind of never ends. You know, what I've always wanted to do with Currents was to create something that was radical in content, but extremely conventional in form, like so that you could think that you're reading The New Yorker or something. And, you know, none of those red flags would go up for a certain kind of reader, but then they can come away with very different conclusions.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's tough. You got to worry about things getting cluttered, you know, like it happens with the armistice line that separates the Palestinian territories. You know, are you going to call that a border? Are you going to call that a demarcation line? Are you going to call it the armistice line? And then you got to stick in a couple more clauses to explain it.
I mean, even just as a journalistic outlet that also publishes literary work, we're always making decisions about how literary is this work and how much room do we have to, you know, say something or not say something. There is a whole bunch of people that we might work with that are envisioning different kinds of futures and, you know, trying to create a future through language, which, you know, there's a question about how much journalists themselves should be on the forefront of that kind of creation or whether that is the work of artists or creative writers. I mean, especially Jasmine, since you're, you know, you were doing magazine writing, which is kind of on a spectrum.
It's funny, Dahlia, when you were saying that you're a journalist first, that's an ethos that I respect and I think that I don't necessarily carry for myself because of the type of work I do. I write like celebrity profiles for the most part, right? I think that because my primary mission is not to inform, then I think for me, the ethic of journalism guides me less in my day-to-day than like my assemblage of lived identities. And so it was very frustrating for me as not only a Black, young, queer employee of the New York Times, but also like a longtime employee of the New York Times, being forced out. Once my race became like a politic and not just a pigment, I found that really frustrating because there were all these instances in my experience or my career, I felt like the Times really traded off of my various identities. And there are times in which like I agreed. There are times where as a member of the team of the New York Times Magazine, I would see an assignment and I would say like, no, I think I should do this. Or I think someone of whatever XYZ identity should do this because of the perspective that can bring, because of like the level of comfort that a subject might get was a really huge thing for me. There were so many times in my career where I would show up for an interview and all the subject would know is that someone from the New York Times was coming. And then I would show up just like armpit hair, dreads, Black girl with tattoos. And then we were able to sort of to forge a different sort of relationship than I think they were expecting. And I think that worked to the Times' advantage many, many times. And so it was very frustrating for me when I wanted to enact or live out the politics that came with that.
I was talking actually about 2 years ago to an editor-in-chief of a very large legacy magazine that I won't name, who just basically said, like, I just can't cover Israel-Palestine anymore in the magazine, not frequently, because I can't deal with like the letter-writing campaigns. And, you know, I've dealt with this in my position, even at Jewish Current, you know, we'll get, especially on a Peter Beinart article, we'll get dozens of letters all saying essentially the same thing and taking issue with one or another language choice or framing. And I know that this has been a tactic of the ADL and the AJC for decades. And I do think that in addition to other things, this has contributed to setting the standards and the norms for these organizations, that they know what is going to provoke backlash that they have to deal with. And I just sort of wonder with what is going on now with organizations like Writers Against the War on Gaza, but other kind of watchdogs generally who are putting more pressure from the left on these institutions, if we think that that is something that's going to help, or how we think about the role of pressure in shaping media. If we don't think that journalists are necessarily on the forefront of this, can activists play a role?
I'm a Christian, so I love shame, right? I think shame is like the most effective tool that we have in our toolboxes. So in many ways, I do want to say yes, but I also worry that it engenders this idea of us versus them, and it helps only to like calcify this idea that anyone who sort of disavow journalistic work is immediately written off as an activist, whether or not you are a journalist, right? And so I think as much as I would like activism to be more and more effective, I think that it is probably most beneficial in a newsroom's relationship with its readers, but not necessarily what's going on inside of a newsroom.
I mean, maybe another way of saying what you're saying is that it's more effective for activists to cloak themselves in the journalistic process, like to be writing letters to the editor, than it is to be, you know, standing in the New York Times lobby. I mean, I think that has a role, but you're saying the newsrooms themselves dismiss those people as activists as opposed to participants in the readership.
Yes. I think the most effective way to foment change internally is to go the letters to the editor route to sort of support the people within who are trying to create change. I think the best way to have an effect on the reputation of a newsroom, or again, its relationship with its readers, is to go the more like external activist events that we've seen from organizations like WAWOG.
Obviously, I'm interested in a lot of the same things activists are. They're some of my dearest friends in the world, but I don't really consider myself an activist. You know, maybe it's like I'm in a related place in the larger war of ideas, but not that particular route. I mean, that's how just how I conceive of myself. I'm sure that there's a lot of people out there who would look at my writing and me on the internet and the stuff that I edit and say, you're an activist journalist, but but that's just not how I think of myself.
Yeah. I wonder, is there room for something in between? Is that a conversation we should even be having? Or should we just accept that some journalists have points of view based on their experiences or their intellect? And again, neutrality is fake, and it doesn't mean that you can't be a good journalist anyway.
I feel like for me, I think there should be a distinction, because when I see activists in Palestine, for example, people that I know are activists, like they go to demonstrations and they raise the flag and everything. And then I see them saying that they're journalists. I don't know, maybe I'm an asshole, but like, I don't like it. I appreciate that they're writers. I could call them that, but I don't know if you're a journalist, even though like we might hold the same viewpoints, you know, and we probably do. And I don't mind using some of the activism tools to achieve what needs to be achieved, but you'll never see me in a demonstration holding a flag, for example.
I mean, Dahlia, I wonder about this because I also wonder if it's just a response to being in this business for a long time and seeing a lot of Zionist journalists who are constantly out there with flags and nobody says anything.
Yeah, because I have to hold myself to a higher standard and I can't get away with the shit that they're getting away with. And so it's twofold. I have to fight harder to be taken seriously and I have to be more quote unquote neutral or whatever. But also on the other hand, like I have a respect for this profession. And yes, my background is obviously Palestinian and, you know, I have thoughts and ideas and whatnot, but what I put down on paper is not going to be like the terrorist Israeli colonial state. I mean, irrespective of what I think, my words have to be measured for them to carry weight and for people to take me seriously. Obviously, the fact that I'm Palestinian is the reason why I'm a journalist. It's not that like I'm disassociating myself from my Palestinianism. I mean, it feeds into it. And everything I've been doing for the past 20 years has been about Palestine. But I have to fight that much harder to not necessarily fit in. I don't want to fit in. I've never once written anything that I wasn't comfortable with, but to actually be allowed into this space that's mainstream media.
I mean, I appreciate Dahlia talking about the craft that, you know, as much as I assume everybody here wants to like jettison some of the old shitty things about the way journalism worked, like also it is a craft with a history of how to do it. And it's worth at least thinking through those things and not reflexively just throwing them all out. Another consideration of mine is that like I want the most people to read the piece and be persuaded by it. And like, look, we're The Intercept. I know that like a lot of like centrist libs and right wingers are not going to be reading us. But if they do, I don't want them to just be able to dismiss it out of hand. And that doesn't mean I'm like kowtowing to them in the language that we use. But it does mean that I'm not going to like gratuitously alienate them. Like if I'm going to alienate them, it's going to be because there's a good reason to. And the other thing that I just want to say that has been shocking but not surprising in this current war is that it's just really crazy to watch what Palestinians in this profession have to deal with. You see the campaign of total erasure that's happening in the way people respond to Palestinian journalists. It's extremely harrowing to watch. It's a totally different ballgame. I mean, the things that happened to Palestinian journalists, like, never happened to me being an Iranian who's worked on Iran stuff. Like, I have so much respect for people like Dahlia that just, like, stay with it and keep their heads in the game and do it because, I mean, I don't know how you do it, to be honest.
I don't know. I don't know, honestly, but I do think that obviously, I mean, you know, the physical toll that Palestinian journalists are under in Gaza, like we've got 90 journalists who were killed. And then the things that they're going through, because not only are they our eyes and ears on the ground, but they're also living the war. They're hungry, they're thirsty, they're everything. You know, they're displaced from their homes and there's a cost.
Yeah. I mean, Ali, you brought up craft. And in preparation for this podcast, I was actually reading a lot from poets. And I was reading from Solma Sharif from a piece called The Poetry of Proximity. And she talks about how the state exerts or at least attempts authority over us in many ways, including its use of language, passive construction, missing subjects, riotous chiasmus, etc. A combination of rhetorical flourish, euphemism, and passivity provide the state with the means to justify formally warfare. And then I also read a piece called Notes on Craft by Fargo Nissim Tabaki, who's our artist in residence at Jewish Currents, and talks about how craft itself is a machine for regulation, estrangement, and sanitization. He says, Palestine and all the struggles with which it is bound up require of us in any and all forms of speech going forward a commitment to constant and escalating betrayals of this machine. It requires that we poison and betray craft at all turns. It might mean writing things that are unpublishable and forcing publishers into doing it anyway. It might mean circumventing or ignoring the structures of publishing in favor of means of circulation outside the bounds of capital and therefore free from the grasp of the invisible hand. It might mean boycott pressure and refusing to allow the return of the oppressive dailiness in any space we inhabit. And, you know, these are two much longer pieces about craft in particular. You know, they're both poets. Fargo's also a theater maker. And obviously, there's been a lot of resistance on this call, at least, to thinking about that kind of intruding on the craft of journalism on some level. But how do those words hit you all? Like, how do we think about refusing the kind of grammar of state violence in our work as journalists? I mean, we've talked so far a little bit almost about omitting words, trying not to use words that are tinged in this direction, but also not to use words tinged in that direction. And that leaves us with another set of words, but also a whole bunch of words that we can't use. That's one tactic that we've talked about. But how do we think about it?
I mean, you know, I understand and I respect it. And I'm all for questioning the order of things that have come before, because that order of things has been unjust to a whole lot of people, and we should. But I also want to think about political progress in a strategic way, you know, which is not to say necessarily incremental, but strategic at least. And I would be hard pressed to look back at the history of journalism and not see that there's stuff that has come before that I can learn from. And that's what I mean by craft. I'm not ready to throw all that out. I do think of myself as part of the improvement of this tradition. And also I try to be cognizant of being in a political project that's bringing more people over to my side and the side of justice for people who haven't had it before.
Yeah, I mean, the art of crafting or craft, you know, it's something we can build on. So it's not like something that's like built in stone. So our own rendition of it, or like our own thoughts on it, or, you know, however we want to mold it, we're already doing that by breaking into spaces that aren't built for people like us and using the craft, but in a way that also respects our own principles and our own thoughts and doesn't betray those. So I don't think, you know, saying that we're respecting the craft is like adhering to the oppressive white man. I understand like where that craft came from and how this craft like traditionally has sidelined people of color and people of a certain class and everything. But for people like us, it's not black or white, you know, like we have to work with a lot of forces. We have to swim against a lot of different tides. At the end of the day, we are changing the craft. And I believe that we can if we want to, you know, I mean, I don't know how far we're going to get, but I got to at least try, because there's hardly any Palestinian journalists out there that can like speak and write in English like really fluently. And even if the interest in these people is just, you know, so you can be the token Palestinian, I mean, I don't care.
Thank you all for joining me today. This has been another episode of On the Nose. If you liked it, please share it. And please subscribe to Jewish Currents, jewishcurrents.org. Thanks a lot. See you next time.